You're listening to the WFYI Weekly News Podcast for the week of November 2nd, 2015. I'm Christopher Ayers. This week, a recap of this week's local elections.
The actual districts that swung the council one way or another were a little bit more of a shock.
An Indianapolis jazz musician hits the big screen.
I kind of just decided to go on a whim. I really had no idea that I would get the part.
And an update from State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney as she follows a group of first-year teachers. Those stories are coming up. Please stay tuned. Election season has come and gone across the state of Indiana, and Indianapolis and Marion County residents have selected a new mayor. Democrat Joe Hogsett took a big lead over his Republican opponent, Chuck Brewer, as polls closed Tuesday night and never looked back, winning by about 25 percentage points. City County Council Democrats were also victorious. They maintained their one-seat majority in the city legislature, even as changes to district maps and the council's structure left many observers thinking the party would be at a disadvantage. So what will a Hogsett administration look like? To ask these questions, we go to WFYI city reporter Ryan Delaney, who's been covering the story for the past several months. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Chris.
So the mayor's race played out pretty much exactly like many believed it would, with a large victory for Joe Hogsett. Why do you think that is?
Hogsett always had the name recognition and then a huge fundraising edge, that 4-to-1 campaign war chest that meant that he was on television all summer and just much more connected, whereas Chuck Brewer always struggled to really differentiate himself and, you know, be known to voters.
I mean, Hogsett was just much more recognizable, had a lot of money. So he spoke to supporters after Chuck Brewer conceded Tuesday. Let's take a quick listen to that.
And now is the time for us to come together again, as we were intended to do, regardless of party or race or faith or station in life. For we are, in Indianapolis, one city.
So, Ryan, what does the mayor-elect's victory speech tell us, if anything, about what kind of mayor he will be?
Well, obviously, Hogsett likes the lofty tone, the grandiose speech. Quoted Bobby Kennedy, a political icon of his, in that speech. And, you know, he's got a master's in theology. He likes to dip into the biblical verses as well. He talked a lot about casting away the despair of violence. Homicide numbers kept ticking up throughout this election. Public safety is always a big issue, but even more so as we're on pace to have another very high year for homicide rates. After that speech, we still don't really know too much about what his administration is going to look like. He has hinted very little at key posts like public safety director, chief of police, saying that those kind of things weren't on his mind during the election. So not too many hints there yet.
So let's move on and take a look at the council. A bit of a structural change to the body itself. There's now 25 seats as opposed to 29, but not much change in its political makeup. Were there any surprises Tuesday?
Things kind of ended up the way, you know, big picture people thought they were going to be, but the actual districts that swung the council one way or another were a little bit more of a shock. Jared Evans, a Democrat in the 22nd district, beating Republican Councilor Bob Lutz, was one that no one really saw coming. Ben Hunter, another very well-respected councilor, ended up losing in his district. His lines got drawn into a much more democratically favoring part of the city, and that was just too much for him. Republicans picked up on the north side, Broad Ripple area district, one that was held by Democrat Kip Two. Colleen Fanning ended up winning that. You know, that was a very high-profile race with a lot of money. So things overall kind of how we thought they would be, but not necessarily the councilors left standing that we anticipated.
So, Ryan, Indiana had one of the worst turnouts in the country after last year's federal midterm elections. And for Marion County this year, according to unofficial numbers, turnout was incredibly low, just below 23%. What's going on here?
Well, abysmal turnout, obviously, and seemingly increasing apathy. We keep setting new records every couple of years for lower turnout. This may be partially to blame on the fact that local municipal elections happen in very off years. There were no statewide elections. Those will be next year. Federal elections will be next year. Last year, we at least had congressional races. So local races, even though they're the ones that most directly affect voters, very hard to drum up a lot of interest in those and get people to go to the polls.
So last question, Ryan. Republicans have maintained a lot of power in this city over the last 50 or so years, at least in the mayor's office or the city county council. Now Democrats control both of those branches of the city government. And so what do Marion County GOP leaders feel this means for their party in the long run?
They're facing an uphill battle that they haven't seen before. It's been a steady slope toward a democratically favored city over the last 10 to 15 years or so. But, you know, we had Republican Mayor Greg Ballard 5 years ago or so. The city county council was still Republicanly controlled. But Republicans have been moving to the outer counties really in droves in the past, you know, couple of election cycles, making it increasingly hard for Republicans to win countywide seats. You now have a Democratic mayor, a Democratic council, a Democratic county prosecutor. So it seems like Republicans are really going to have challenges in winning countywide races. There are still pockets of this county that are Republican strongholds, and the party says that that's where they need to focus their resources now, finding seats that they have a chance to win at and then put their resources there so hopefully they can be successful. You also have, you know, this election in particular for mayor, Greg Ballard announcing that he was not going to seek re-election really kind of caught Republicans here off guard. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they were at a disadvantage just from the starting gun of finding a strong person to run against Joe Hogsett. We mentioned his financial advantage and name recognition that Chuck Brewer didn't have. And there weren't any big name Republicans that had the ability to maybe challenge Hogsett closer that rose to the top initially. So they might be a little bit leaderless right now, certainly have some soul searching to do in terms of you know, where they're going to be competitive and how they're going to compete in future elections.
Okay, it's going to be very interesting going forward, and I'm sure we'll talk to you some more. All right, thank you, Ryan.
You're welcome.
For brand new teachers, the first few weeks of the school year are filled with excitement and anticipation. But by late fall, that changes. Research shows that the toughest part for teachers is usually right now. State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney is following a group of first-year teachers from across the state. Today, she reports on the challenges they're facing as they experience the emotional roller coaster teaching can be.
That roller coaster is happening right now for Sarah Draper in her second grade classroom.
I feel like it's just going, we're just going up and down. Like the first.
Draper teaches at Helmsburg Elementary in Brown County. She's generally pretty positive, so it might be hard to sense the stress in her voice. Draper, along with the rest of her first year peers, has been optimistic up to this point. But the stresses of the job are starting to take a toll.
The first few weeks were really easy behavior-wise, like no problems. Then it got, you know, like a little bit more difficult, like saw some more challenges, and then it got better. And then it's like it's gone back to like having struggles.
Draper is trying to create consistency in her classroom by establishing routines, but her kids are still struggling. Her stress level is mounting along with her responsibilities. She spent the entire month of October scheduling, preparing for, and actually having parent-teacher conferences. In the midst of that, she had to prepare for her principal to come evaluate her while she was teaching a lesson.
And that's just stressful anyway, because it's 10 minutes long. I mean, there's just not a lot. I mean, you have to hit so many things in 10 minutes, and it's just, it's impossible to do. You know, I had it, and it went fine.
If you had been rated ineffective, what would have been the biggest disappointment of that? Would it be that your pay would go down, just having that title?
I think having that label would be, well, and like, I feel like just to my confidence, that would have been really, really hard. I honestly, I don't think I would have been able to, like, come back from that. I really don't. I mean, like, you're already questioning, like, am I doing a good job? Am I doing okay? And then to have that labeled ineffective, it would almost be, like, answering that question, like, no, you're not doing your job, and no, like, you're not a good teacher right now.
Draper relies on other teachers for reassurance, to answer questions about classroom management, and for specific behavior questions.
I'm so thankful that I have that support system at school, because I literally don't know what I would do without it. And then I wonder, like, is that ever going to get better? Or, like, am I always going to have that? Like, 10 years down the road, I, like, still don't know what to do, you know, and I just hope that I can figure it out.
IU School of Education professor Robert Koonsman says if new teachers don't find others to lean on during this first year, these tough times can be impossible to get through.
They need support both at school and at home. They need to find mentors, whether they're assigned to them or whether they need to seek them out, like-minded mentors that they can be vulnerable with.
At Nora Elementary in Indianapolis, third-grade teacher Gabe Hoffman stays after school to hang out one-on-one with a student as part of a building-wide mentoring program. He says his fellow third-grade teachers serve as his mentors. They're helping him through his turbulent first few months as he adjusts to the demanding workload.
So, like, I try to get enough done in the morning that I'm out of here, usually by 5:30, 6, after school. So I try to get here at 6 a.m. So it's still usually at 6:30. It's usually about a 12-hour day.
And working 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, on top of grading and class prep at home, plus a second job at a golf course on Sundays, leaves him with little time for anything else.
I said my girlfriend's also a teacher, too. She's a high school teacher. We don't see each other very often, and that's been difficult because we went to separate colleges. And we were finally like, oh, we're back in the same city. And really, we only see each other on, like, Friday nights and sometimes Saturdays.
And Hoffman gets discouraged when he realizes there's not much he can do to make the situation better, at least not his first year. As a third grade teacher, his kids are taking the iRead 3 and iStep for the first time, which means a lot of practice tests. Also, more than half of his kids are in special plans that require extra data collection and stacks of paperwork.
Did you anticipate the amount of time you'd be spending on that kind of stuff?
No. It's not. I mean, I knew it would be there, and I knew that there would be some stuff. But when you're student teaching, you don't see that aspect of any of it. You go in, you make your lesson plans, and you teach.
But is all of this enough to make these two newcomers think about leaving teaching for good?
No, I haven't. I've had thoughts of, like, I can't wait till next year until, like, I just feel like I will be able to prepare so much better. Like, from the first day of school, it's just going to be so much better.
A sentiment Hoffman agrees with. Next October will be better. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Claire McInerney.
Brandon Meeks is an Indianapolis jazz musician, a member of the Indianapolis hip-hop outfit Native Son, and soon he will share the big screen with Academy Award-nominated actor Don Cheadle in a new film about the life of jazz legend Miles Davis. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer had the chance to speak with Meeks earlier this week.
You got to play Ron Carter, one of Miles Davis's bassists.
Right, that's correct.
And how did you get involved with the picture to start with?
I heard of an audition that they were doing very early in the planning of the film. And there's some friends I have over in Cincinnati, Ohio, that I routinely play with. And they were telling me about this audition. And I kind of just decided to go on a whim. I really had no idea that I would get the part, but I just thought it would be fun to just go and try out. And lo and behold, they gave me a call back. Totally surprised.
And then, so you spent several days in New York City where they filmed the movie, because that's where Cheadle really believes that that's where Miles Davis really made it. I mean, really started his whole thing.
Well, actually, the setting of the movie is New York City, but they filmed it in Cincinnati.
Aha.
Because they felt like Cincinnati looked more like New York in the 50s than
that's always
New York
the way it is, isn't it?
Right.
And you said, but this movie is really kind of a story within a story.
That's correct. It's really historical fiction. So It's definitely not anything like the other biopics that you'll see, like Ray or What's Love Got to Do with It. It really creates a story about Miles Davis within the context of his actual history, but instead of like trying to deal with everything that he did, because it's so extensive, I don't think they could really get it into a 2-hour movie. So they kind of created a story that's, you know, it's a really good, compelling story about Miles, and he's going through a battle with his record label, and they kind of really delve into his personality that way. But yeah, it's totally different than anything you would expect from this kind of movie, and I think it was really smart the way they played that.
What did you learn from it in two ways? One, being part of a film as a musician, mm-hmm. How was it similar or different than when you go and play at a venue?
Oh, it was an entirely different animal. You know, when we go in as musicians, when we go and play at a venue, especially when we're doing jazz, you have the chance to kind of just be in the moment and just create as you go. With being on set, you know, everything is scripted, and they have to do everything over and over again to get it right. And so there's a lot of waiting involved, and there's a lot more repetition involved than just performing, because you have to, you know, you have to stand a certain way. They have to make sure you look right in a certain lighting. It's a lot more detailed oriented, things that you normally don't even think about just performing. But to create an authentic look on a camera, they have to do so many things behind the camera to get it to look the way that it's supposed to. So it was a totally new experience for me. I'm really glad I got to do it.
And how do you feel differently about Miles Davis now?
I feel like almost kind of like I've actually had a chance to play with Miles in a way, because Don Cheadle, he did such an overwhelmingly good job with just bringing that character back to life. That, I mean, it was so surreal. I really, you know, felt at times that I was working with Miles Davis, and not to mention that Don Cheadle can actually play trumpet.
That's incredible.
So, you know, and he's really studied Miles' style. So it was a surreal experience. It really kind of just caused me to dig deeper into Miles' history and even learn more about him. Even though, you know, just playing jazz regularly, I kind of deal with
Miles'
music.
You knew a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, but
the movie is Miles Ahead. It should be in wide release next spring. And as we go out here, Native Son's going to be performing in Dayton in a couple of weeks. But we're going to be listening to a little bit of your new music here, Brandon. Give us a quick clip on what this is. And
sure. This piece is called Illusion. It's going to be on my upcoming jazz project. And I think I'm going to title it Illusion. It's just something I wrote just for some of the local musicians here, Rob Dixon, Steve Jones, Greg
Archery.
Some of
the jazz greats. Brandon Meeks, thanks for stopping by today.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's it for this edition of the WFYI Weekly News Podcast. We encourage you to subscribe to this show. You can do so on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also find us on SoundCloud. Just search WFYI. In addition, you can follow us online at WFYI.org, on Twitter at WFYI News, and on Facebook, WFYI. This has been a production of WFYI News, produced at 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Studios in Indianapolis. I'm Christopher Ayers. Thanks for listening.